Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by the Foundation at Hearst Castle, where donors and members experience exclusive events that recreate what it was like to be a guest of William Randolph Hearst, from swimming in the iconic Neptune Pool to dining in Hearst's private guest house overlooking the Pacific Ocean. The Foundation at Hearst Castle's ongoing mission is to support the conservation and restoration of Hearst Castle while offering youth programs for underserved students. Discover how you can become a member by going to foundation@hearstcastle.com and learn how you can support this unique and invaluable mission.
The following are highlights from a two-week road trip through the Eastern Cape region of South Africa that reveals wild animals, sophisticated coastal cities, and rural tribal communities of the Zulu Kingdom and the Xhosa people. It was a real journey, just getting from California to the Indian Ocean side of South Africa, LAX to JFK, to Dakar, Senegal, followed by an overnight in Johannesburg, before finally touching down in the waterfront city of Durban, South Africa. Situated in the heart of the KwaZulu-Natal region, Durban is a surprisingly modern city with one of the continent's largest container ports, a lively waterfront scene, and miles of sandy coastline. There are ample seaside eateries, the world-class Ushaka Marine World, a hip and happening beachside bar scene, and miles of families sunbathing and playing in the surf. So many weird paradoxes here, touching scenes of blacks, whites, Indians, Islamic people, and smatterings of others, all sunbathing and water sliding together in a Durban water park on a sunny Sunday afternoon. But the ugly side of Durban is the repeated attacks, beatings, and murders of foreign nationals trying to eke out a living in Durban. From Indian shopkeepers to Malawian laborers and truck drivers, the episodic xenophobic attacks have been going on for decades. Durban, like much of South Africa, is a melding of modernity, urbanity, and tribal elements. Zipping along Durban's waterfront esplanade, we pass glistening office buildings on our right, while rainbow-hued rickshaws manned by Zulu bullers dressed in colorful, traditional warrior garb, replete with water buffalo horn-adorned headdresses, await their next fare. One of the buffalo warrior rickshaw pullers left an indelibly bad taste in my memory bank when I took a wide-angle photo of the streetscape adjacent to the beach. Unfortunately, the Zulu rickshaw dude thought I was taking a close-up of him, and he instantly came up to me and demanded 140 rand, or $10, for the photo. I told him he was not the focus of my shot, but he instantly got nasty, and to avoid a really bad scene that was getting uglier by the moment, I paid him anyway. Most of the locals encountered were friendly, but there's a noticeable resignation of acceptance, an acceptance of way too much crime and violence. A majority of the family-owned shops throughout town are outfitted with iron-grilled entry doors manned by security guards who vet your entry. The upscale Durban Inn where we stayed was encircled by a high steel fence and entry gate, kind of like a reverse prison. After a night in Durban, overlooking the Indian Ocean, we head inland to the town of Pietermaritzburg. In true British colonial era fashion, we board an ancient steam train and journey through pine and eucalyptus forests before debarking in the Zulu village of Carisbrook. We walk in the rain to the nearby Carisbrook Primary School, where the children eagerly await our arrival. The kids sing songs for us in a semi-decomposed concrete-floored classroom as raindrops drum rhythmically on the rusted corrugated tin roof. Our visit was the biggest event at their amply weather-worn school in quite some time. The rustic, crumbling facility is actually one of the better school buildings in the region. It was rebuilt and a new roof installed by the film crew who utilized the school during location filming of the 1995 Cry the Beloved Country movie. Some rural schools lack windows and desks, and many are heavily vandalized. Outside, patches of grass and weeds invade the mucky red dirt paths that the kids navigate around during recess and en route between home and school. The poverty and lack of possibilities for these little critters is heart-wrenching. Lots of absenteeism, single parents, child abuse, and negligible medical care, threadbare clothing, AIDS-infested relatives, and often an arduous journey just to make it to school and back home. Many will regretfully drop out before making it to the sixth form. Watching and talking with the inquisitive and innocent kids that have so little and probably do not even realize it reminds me that there's scant room for choices in their lives, ample problems, but minimal choices. Having choices in their lives is a luxury, the luxury of choosing what they're going to wear when they get up in the morning to what they're going to eat for breakfast. These little critters know full well exactly what they're going to wear and exactly what they're going to eat, the same as yesterday and the day before that. We leave Carisbrook and pass through numerous small towns and villages. The countryside is dotted with government-funded one-room huts. Mud and dung floors and tin roofs are not uncommon around here, totally bare minimum. Often the walls of wattle and mud or plastered mud bricks. We pass a mind-jarring, jumbled neighborhood of cardboard and tin squatter huts, each domicile not much bigger than a tool shed. And then we glimpse neighboring, elegant, colonial-era farmhouses and rambling modern estates reposing on the nearby hillsides. And then we realize that the cardboard huts are the residence for the people that maintain the mansions. But there is also a very present and viable middle class here, and there are neatly ordered housing developments radiating a pride of ownership. Throughout the region, pine and eucalyptus tree farm operations and citrus groves undulate across the hillsides and beyond the far horizon. The fast-growing eucalyptus is harvested, treated, and used as railway sleepers, fence posts, and pilings. A bonus of spending hours on the road is catching multiple glimpses of indigenous life, such as a crumpled old woman trundling along the roadside with humongous bundles of sticks, sometimes 10 feet long by 3 feet high, precision balanced on their heads, or variously 10-gallon plastic barrels, oversized crates, and humongous swags of laundry riding smugly atop their noggins. En route to the Umgazi River bungalows and spa on the Eastern Cape's wild coast, we pass through numerous small towns and villages. Each small crossroads burg that we motor through, I notice four or more funeral homes with caskets displayed in their front windows. At first, I'm confused as to why there is a preponderance of undertakers in these tiny villages. It suddenly dawns on me that it is due to the sickeningly high percentage of residents infected with AIDS. The ancient tribal Xhosa and Zulu custom of teenage circumcision remains as a tempting rite of passage. Young boys sometimes sneak off against their parents' wishes to have their wieners clipped by the local knife-wielding shaman. The problem is the tribal wiener cutters do not sterilize their implements between surgeries. The odds of one of the kids being infected with the HIV virus is all too great. The chances that a boy will acquire the virus through the ceremonial ritual winds up being a rite of passage to sickness and death. The surrounding countryside is cluttered with tiny, government-funded one-room huts, stimulating speculation about the inhabitants' former digs. Mud and dung floors and rusted tin roofs are so common around here, totally bare minimum. Wattle and mud and mud brick walls, tattered corrugated tin or thatched roofs with weeds and dusty lanes encircling the thresholds. We pass a bombed-out Volkswagen camper van beached in a ravine, slowly decomposing like a rotting baby elephant carcass, but still functioning as the living quarters for a family of four, with a campfire ablaze inside the vehicle's sprung-out side doors as the kids play tag out front. We pass ultra-modern, amply staffed mini-mart petrol stations that are the norm around here. Inside, you'll find high-tech point-of-sale cash registers and cold cases stocked with universal prepackaged treats. Tab and Coke are hot sellers here. But there's also bound to be an adjacent Wimpy Burger chain outlet nearby. Watching cadres of minimally paid workers zip around the stations, checking tire pressure, wiping windscreens, and pumping gas with pride and smiles serve as testimonials to the perseverance of the human condition and resilient spirits. There's actually a practical reason for the top-heavy staffing at petrol stations around here, and for that matter, throughout the service industry, from hired hands on ranches, farms, and plantations to amply staffed highway maintenance crews. The gas station window washers might depend on tips, often as little as 10 or 20 cents per transaction just to make their wages. Their menial jobs are encouraged as a means of staunching the horrifically high unemployment rate. Employers wouldn't think of downsizing for economic efficiency, as they know it would compound the unemployment situation. Watching these minimally paid drones zip around the station with pride and sometimes forced smiles serve as testimonials to the perseverance of the human condition. Back at the Burn Valley Inn where we're staying, a grizzled female porter, probably around 45 years of age, but weathered enough to easily pass for 60, was summoned with a clap of the manager's hands to shuttle my suitcase to my room. Before I could intervene, the wizened woman, as compact as an underfed sixth grader, had hiked my suitcase atop her head and trundled off, hands-free, at a fast clip towards my quarters. The woman was so tiny I could have packed her neatly inside my suitcase. The weather is supposed to continue with downpours tomorrow. It is the summer monsoon season here, and it isn't unexpected. We leave the land of the Zulu and enter the domain of the Xhosa people.
Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by the Foundation at Hearst Castle, where donors and members experience exclusive events that recreate what it was like to be a guest of William Randolph Hearst, from swimming in the iconic Neptune Pool to dining in Hearst's private guesthouse overlooking the Pacific Ocean. The Foundation at Hearst Castle's ongoing mission is to support the conservation and restoration of Hearst Castle while offering youth programs for underserved students, preserving the past and inspiring future generations of dreamers. These children experience a world of science, technology, engineering, art, and math at Hearst Castle, STEAM, along with studying the legacy of Julia Morgan, one of the most important women in the history of engineering and architecture. The foundation at Hearst Castle not only changes the lives of children, but also provides lifetime memories and unrivaled experiences for our generous donors and members. Discover how you can become a member by going to foundation@hearstcastle.com and learn how you can support this unique and invaluable mission. You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
This is Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting here with Tom Wilmer. Please support your local NPR station. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. If I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.